Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The last few years have brought profound changes to the city of Detroit. A financial emergency was declared, and despite opposition from residents and the city council, a financial manager was appointed. Just this month, Mayor Dave Bing announced he would step down from office at the end of his term, and a crowded field of new candidates have announced their intentions. A new book from MSU Press examines the complex history of Detroit, with a focus on race relations around and after the 1967 riots, with some ideas about the city's future as well. MSU professor of geography Joe Darden is the co-author of the book, Detroit: Race Riots, Racial Conflicts, and Efforts to Bridge the Racial Divide. Dr. Darden is also the former dean of the MSU Urban Affairs Program, and he joins us now. Joe Darden, nice to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Go a little bit deeper here as to what the book is about here, beyond what I said.
Okay. This book examines first the causes of the riots of 1967. Some people call them the rebellion. And also, what socioeconomic changes occurred after the riots to improve the residents of the city of Detroit. And then after that, it looks at alternatives for the people of Detroit to improve themselves if they're willing to take advantage of those opportunities.
How would you compare efforts to help Detroit recover after the 67 riots from government, from business people, from residents, to the efforts today to help Detroit recover from its financial and social problems?
Well, let me make it very clear. This book is not a message to the politicians of Detroit. It is a message to the residents of Detroit who wishes to improve their social mobility. After looking at the history of Detroit, going all the way back to 1967, the efforts involving politicians, the state of Michigan, and others, we note in the book that the group that should be the heroes in all of this were the nonprofit organizations that tried every day to improve the city and make it better. They could not, though, match the disinvestment of the investors who were willing to invest outside the city of Detroit and not in the city. As a result of the disinvestment, the city of Detroit continued to decline. Now, we argue that the reason it declined in terms of disinvestment was because investment tends to follow race and class. The investors followed the predominantly white population to move to the suburb rapidly after the riots. The investors went with them and invested there and disinvested in the city. Given that, the residents of Detroit have to make some decisions. What do you do? Do you try and improve the city of Detroit, or do you do this? Do you find out where the high-achieving elementary schools are and public schools in general, and you enroll your kids there, even if it means moving outside of the city of Detroit, or do you stay in the city and try to improve the educational system? After 40 years of effort, we argue in the book that that is not a good alternative. The better alternative is to explore outside of the city, find the high-achieving schools, and move there. That is the best way to improve. If you have a child in the school system, you want to improve their education, that is the best way to do it. And that decision can be made by the parents themselves. They don't need to rely on the mayor, they don't need to rely on city council, and they don't need to rely on the governor. They can make that choice. Now, the second choice they had prior to the emergency manager was they could vote for somebody to represent them. They could vote for a school board, they could vote for the city council, they could vote for the mayor. That choice has been taken away. So the only choice left now is to try and find the best neighborhood to move into, and that would be the best way to improve yourself in terms of education and in terms of access to jobs and other opportunities.
This is you refer to this in your book, I believe, as the spatial mobility option.
That's exactly right.
Do I have that right?
That is correct.
What does that say about the people who do not have the resources to go for those options and are left in the city of Detroit, though?
Well, let me just say this. I think it is a long-held myth that it's cheaper to live in the city of Detroit than to live elsewhere. That is a myth. It is not documented by the evidence. The evidence is that it's very expensive to live in Detroit. And we have documented in the book where you can take the same amount of rent you're paying in the city of Detroit and move elsewhere. And you will then improve in terms of your neighborhood. You'll get access to public schools. You'll get access to better job opportunities just by moving. That is what we've documented in the book. So do not believe that it is cheaper to live in Detroit. Your car insurance, for example, in Detroit will be five times as high. just because you live in the city. You need to move, explore your options, and see what they are. However, if you're satisfied with the public school system, if you're satisfied with the taxes you pay, if you're satisfied with the services, then stay there. This is not to say you should move if you're happy. If you're unhappy, you have other options to explore outside of 8 Mile Road. You're not now trapped in there as you were prior to the 1968 Fair Housing Act. You now have those options to move. And that's what we explore in the book, is to move outside if you can.
You are debunking a really powerful myth. It sounds to me there is this Phoenix Rising dimension to Detroit in 2013. The city seems to have, there's been a lot of reporting on the city becoming some kind of magnet for young, idealistic, reform-minded people, in part, I think, because of a reputation for lower rents. But you are saying it actually costs less in dollars to live outside the city.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You see, what you buy with rent is essentially, you rent the neighborhood. You don't just rent the apartment, you rent the neighborhood. And one has to sort of say here, for this amount of rent, what do I get for it? If you compare renting the neighborhood, you get access to better schools because they're public schools. You don't get that in the city of Detroit unless you're willing to pay for a private school. That's the cost. Again, I mentioned before, car insurance. That's a cost. So when it comes to total cost of living in one neighborhood compared to another, you will come out ahead if you explore the option of living outside. I must say again, if you're happy in Detroit, stay there. But you need to explore your options and then make that choice. That's a wise one. And not believe in this mythology that I cannot afford it. This book it documents places that you can't afford with no increase in the rent. In fact, some places, well, you can move into with less rent than Japan in the city of Detroit.
I'm envisioning that sign that says, "With the last person out the door, kindly turn out the light." Here, I'm envisioning a very desolate and even more desolate city of Detroit in the future than there is now. If you're advocating this spatial mobility option,
well, here's the thing. Cities must compete for their residents. They must offer them something that will make them stay. That may be jobs, good school system, public safety. These are the things that cities must do. You have to compete for your residents. And if you don't offer them those options that they need, they have a right to move. People have always done that throughout history. They always move towards opportunity. That's why they move, either the job that they want, a high-achieving public school, better neighborhood, public safety. That has been the mobility of people throughout history. Keep in mind, most whites who lived in Detroit at one time left Detroit over time. And nobody said at the time they were leaving, well, what do we do? Who's going to think about the people who left behind? That question didn't come up as much as it does now. However, many people in Detroit at that time also wanted to move. I call it selective suburbanization. In other words, blacks wanted to move, many of them did, but could not. Because of discrimination in housing, they had to stay there. Against their will, by the way, they stayed. Now that the system has opened up somewhat, many of them are moving, in fact. And I'm suggesting that you have to explore your options, make a wise choice, and then decide what you want to do.
And you claim that the racial dynamic is really at the heart of the decline of the city of Detroit.
No question about it. Race is in the forefront. You have two factors here. Race, which drives it, followed by class, because those two operate together. And then the third one is space. Place of residence matter. We cannot underestimate that. And what you've had throughout history is this separation of place of residence by race and class. And that is what perpetuated the whole situation. We call this in the book the demographic imbalance. As long as that demographic imbalance exists between city and suburb, based on race, class, and residential location, this problem is not going to be solved.
What's stopping the race and class dynamic from just moving to the suburbs as well?
Well, here's the thing now. There's still some resistance on the part of some whites who are in the suburb to people from Detroit moving into those suburbs. However, some residents in the city of Detroit may not know that the option exists to move there. They may assume that it costs too much. They may assume that the resistance is going to be so great they don't want to go through it. Or they may assume that if they stay in Detroit and fight, they can improve the situation. We document over 40 years of effort, and they tried hard. That's why I always praise those nonprofits, because they tried to do it. But it did not work. You had the situation with the black mayors. They thought that would be their savior. It didn't work. Black City Council didn't work. Those things didn't work because the investors were pulling the strings. They decided whether or not be more investment or not, and they decided that they did not want to continue to invest in Detroit, and they invested elsewhere. That is not uncommon for investors to do that. It is very highly unlikely that investors will invest in neighborhoods that are predominantly black and predominantly poor. That is something that's rare indeed. They often will invest in neighborhoods that are predominantly white and predominantly middle and upper class. That has been the trend, that's the pattern, and I think that pattern will continue.
You do think that pattern will continue? I mean, it's not 1967 anymore.
I think that pattern will continue, yes.
And why do you feel that?
Because, again, race and class still drives investment. Okay. That's why I say that. It still drives it. We haven't gotten over that yet. That still drives it. Now, by changing the demographic imbalance so that race and class do not drive this thing, investors may invest there. But as long as investors see a situation which is overwhelmingly black, overwhelmingly poor, their investment, when they have a choice, will be to invest in those neighborhoods that are predominantly white and predominantly middle and upper class. That is what they do.
We're talking with Dr. Joe Darden. His most recent book is called Detroit, Race Riots, Racial Conflicts, and Efforts to Bridge the Racial Divide. After months and months of anticipation, Detroit's being run by emergency manager Kevin Orr. What impact will the emergency manager situation in Detroit have on what you're talking about here?
Here's the thing. The emergency manager will squeeze whatever resources there are in Detroit. It's already essentially a city that is poor. It will squeeze that even more. That means that either there'll be higher taxes on the people who are there, but the services may not improve. Until anyone can encourage the investors to invest more, to create more jobs in the city, and nothing much will happen. And I argue that given the demographic imbalance, that's not going to happen because they're still competing, by the way, with those places elsewhere. They have a choice of investing in the city of Detroit or investing outside. Most of the investment has occurred outside of the city over that 40-year period.
What do you make of Dan Gilbert's efforts, though? Those are very highly publicized. He's investing big time in downtown.
Well, I think that's fine. Let him do that. But you have to look at it in a comparative context. Is that a small amount compared to those investing outside? I think it is still. Keep in mind, you have to look at it comparatively speaking. Investment is still occurring disproportionately outside. I think it will continue to do that. That has been the trend. That continues to be the case. However, his efforts, I applaud him for that. But I don't think it's going to make a difference sufficiently enough to make people stay there.
MSU professor of geography, former dean of urban affairs programs, Joe Darden is the co-author of the book Detroit, Race Riots, Racial Conflicts, and Efforts to Bridge the Racial Divide. Joe Darden, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Slavery in Film. This year, half a dozen films focusing on slavery are coming out. Why so many? We'll explore that. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.